Thanks for coming.
Not
you,
at all.
As you say, I know you don't do this kind of thing much, so
no, I don't.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think that I've done about 50 interviews now. You're the only person who hasn't been in the creative department. In fact, you're the only person, the only non-creative person who's ever won the DNAD Presence Award.
I didn't like to think I was a non-creative person.
Yeah, that didn't
but
sound
I wasn't
great.
In the creative
well, you weren't
department.
In the creative. You didn't have a title as creative.
I did
which
not.
Which we're going to get to later.
I did.
Because I'm going to ask you why that was. But why have you been the only person ever to win the DNAD Presence Award who isn't sat in the creative department, do you think?
Oh, I think it was the work we did at CDP. And since I was the kind of producer at CDP, if you see what I mean, and had all these wonderful creative people. I mean, quite extraordinary group of people gathered there. Neil Godfrey, Tony Brignall, Parker, Ridley worked with us, Hugh worked with us. I mean, it was truly remarkable. We just won so many awards in London and in Cannes, more than any other agency by a mile, that they thought, well, why don't we give it to him? But I think it was given to me by the creative people, influenced by DNA, by Colin Dickinson Pearce, because, well, why shouldn't Frank have one? He sold all our work and he kind of encouraged us to do things. So that's why I got
it. Well, your answer's more modest than I would expect, in a way, because it's very unusual that that happens. And even though you were running the agency, often people don't want to give anyone credit other than the person who wrote it, or possibly the person, the creative director who signed it off. I think it's more than just you happen to be the guy at the top.
Oh, well, I think that's pretty important, actually. I mean, if you haven't faced the tyranny of a blank sheet of paper,
yeah.
You should do, because I've always filled with admiration at people who have to sit there and look at the piece of paper and think, I've got to think of an idea. I've got a little bit of a strategy, normally quite simple, and I've got to think of a very fresh idea. I think that's very hard. I was always very keen that the people who did the work should get the credit, have their names on it, have their names on the awards.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of agencies, I mean, I remember J. Walter Thompson in the early days used to say the advertising was done by J. Walter Thompson Group. They would never put anybody's name down, I think in case anybody stole them. But
well, I don't know when the last DNAD book you looked at, but often now there are sometimes 30 or 40 names. So they've gone so far into sharing out the credit that there's often
good.
40 names.
They should do.
Yeah.
They should do.
But in a way, you're heading more to J. Walter Thompson Group, aren't you? Think
the next I see what you mean. They don't put a name actually on an ad.
Well, they will put an ad. They may put a poster, but there may be 25 names of the breakdown. And you think, part of me thinks that seems a lot for seven words and a picture on a poster.
Well, no, posters, it's done by a good art director, a good writer, or the two of them. I mean, there's only two people can be involved, you know. You can't have six people writing the ad.
Mm.
And at Colletts, we used to only put one team on a campaign to do. We never spread it about and said, we'll see who comes up with what.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Your job, you've got to do it. And it put terrible pressure on them, I know, but
yeah,
it made them do better work. Because they couldn't think, well, if I can't crack it, Jim down the corridor will crack it. It was great responsibility. So that's why I did that.
So one of the things I think's different about today than it seems in earlier times is that I suppose the more people I interview, the more I feel like your generation is slightly different the way it approached advertising to today's generation. I think it meant more. You had more respect for it. And it was a bigger part of your life. And I think when I look at lots of pieces, a huge generalisation, but now it feels like it's a job. It's a way of making money, and some people may be able to make a lot of money or a bit of money, but I think it meant more. Now, I interviewed Richard Foster, who you know.
I do.
And he was telling me that when he first started out, he would be on the tube reading the Evening Standard, and if there was a Volkswagen ad coming, he would get palpitations with excitement as a 19-year-old, because he started as a child. He would get palpitations. He was so excited to see it and read it. And it just seemed to mean so much more. It wasn't, this is a way to earn some money to buy a house. It was a much more fundamental thing. And I don't know why that's changed. I don't know whether that's because in those years, people were trying to change culture more or...
Oh, I think that... I mean, a lot of things have changed. There's no question about that. And the things that have changed in relationship to advertising have had a dramatic effect. I've no doubt about that. For example, in those days you used to get 15% commission, and you could have time and work on it. Now they get on average about 8.5. Now anybody with a brain can say, it's like going in a shop, you can't expect the same for half price. But I think starting with that, there's no doubt that advertising was a very exciting thing for all us to go into. And there was quite a lot of difference. I mean, it started in the age, of course, of the creative revolution in Britain anyway, the music, the fashion, the photography, film direction, all manner of things are changing in that 60s, 70s period, and advertising really was part of that, and it was an enormous fun. I mean, we just had such a lark doing the work. And I don't know, I talked to my kids today, who are both in their 20s, they say to me, you know, Papa, people my age don't want to go into advertising now. And I said, well, why not? I said, well, there's so many other things to do. You know, we could go and work at the platform or that kind of thing. We could, I don't know, open a pub. We could go and work in the city. They don't really find advertising very interesting. No. And when, you know, I got to Colletts, I was surrounded by these fantastic writers and art directors who were all brilliant. And I thought, my God, this is exciting. What a hoot. And we all had about 20 years of real fun. And the work was very strong. And the agency, of course, was what it was. Mm. And then I started low, and that did pretty well. So I think the lack of desire of a lot of young people to go into advertising. And as you've said, I think it is a job. Mm.
I think it's also become more middle class, ironically. It seemed to have a much more diverse range of people.
Well, there certainly was. I mean, I don't know quite how it works now. I do know that a lot of working class kids went into advertising then, without degrees, left school, got a job. I mean, I got a job as a postboy at J. Walter Thompson at £4 a week. Alan Parker got a job writing wanted ads in the newspaper.
That's
job
right,
wanted, that kind of thing. And we just gradually grew up.
So did you get a job in JWT mailroom to get into advertising, or was that just something you thought I'd do for a bit?
No, to get into advertising.
So at the time?
At the time, I felt advertising was a kind of thing that interested me. And I thought, well, how can I get a job in there? I'm not a writer, I'm not an art director. Didn't go to art school. So I applied to a lot of people for a job, and I got a job offer from the Aberdeen Courier, which is a newspaper. Well, it's a very long way away, Aberdeen.
Yeah.
And I got a job offer from JWT, and I took that, and that was your way up the ladder, traffic boy, production person, then to an account executive.
So that was that 1960?
I got my first job about 1960 at Thompson's.
So what advertising had you seen around before that that made you think this looks like an exciting business?
I don't know that I had. I don't know that I had, really. Maybe I only went into advertising a bit by luck, because I wasn't passionate about it as a young man growing up. I must be an ad man. But once I got into it a bit and I started to take an interest in it, and started to see, as we all did, what was going on in America and Doyle Dane.
So would you have been aware of that when you were at JWT? Not surely in the post.
I would have been, yes.
Because, really, you were exposed to that?
Think because the creative people were exposed to it, not necessarily Thompson's creative people, but you met everybody in the pubs and everything.
Right.
I mean, it was a pub society then. You all met in the pub afterwards, and if you had somebody worked, I mean, we were Colletts was next to McCann. Now, you wouldn't want to talk to McCann about creative work, but you'd all meet in the pub and they'd argue and that kind of thing. And everybody became quite obsessed in that period about what Birnbach and Helmut Krone, Bob Gage, Levinson, what they were all doing, particularly for Volkswagen, but also for quite a lot of or Bucks, quite a lot of other clients. And it was a new way of doing things. It was witty for a start. Yeah. And I think most people, particularly the British, we have a sense of humour. We like wit in advertising. And so if you look at a lot of the work we then subsequently did, which was not really any way copy of Doyle, Dane, Burnback, because it was the British way of having a revolution, yeah, not the American way of having a revolution. And so we, you know, Britain is a class-ridden society, yeah, so we'd poke fun at, yeah, the upper classes and the working classes. But never mean, never nasty, just a lark. And you remember one of the campaigns we did, which people still love today, which was Joan Collins and Leonard Rossiter.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they were so funny, the two of them. And, you know, Leonard was a very funny man.
Was he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was his idea. Right. Alan Parker was shooting the first one. It's his idea to do the...
to do the drink thing.
Drink trick. He said to Alan, well, why don't you do that old trick we do on the, you know, in the clubs? Time is it? Oh, and that's how that arose. And I think the other thing...
Frank. So who spotted that to say, let's do that joke again? Because sometimes you would think, that was that ad, let's do it different.
Well, that would be... I mean, I had a lot of to do in that kind of thing, because it's like... I remember on Hovis saying to the guys when we did the first commercial, and I was saying, for Christ's sake, don't change the music. The music is just perfect, and we'll run that for years. And we did. So I think if you could take an essential element, Hamlet, Mask, Air on a G-string, and keep that going so people hear the music and think, oh, I like this ad, if they're in the kitchen and pop in and look at it, whereas as opposed to... what I think a lot of people do today is pop out and look away from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But casting was interesting, thinking of Leonard and Joan. Every time I see Joan in a restaurant in Chelsea, she always says to me, Frank, have you got any ads for me? Not at the moment, Joan, I've retired. But we always, when we used celebrities, we didn't use them as promoters of the product, as in looking at camera saying, hello, I'm, I always use the, and I'm afraid that has come back. It's talking heads.
Yeah.
Whereas we wrote a script which was fun to act in, and then we chose the people who were good
at actors.
Best
people. Yeah.
And they were actors. We're using for Tesco, the Sybil Fawlty or Dudley Moore, but they didn't have to promote the product. They have to be themselves. And I remember we used Eric and Ernie for
Texaco,
and I remember saying to them when we were wanted to renew the contract, and I said, you really like doing these ads. He said, listen, Frank, this is Eric, he said, we have to do the Christmas special. And that is an enormous amount of work. And therefore, we cannot be on television every month, all the time. So your ads, which we do, keep us in front of the public while we're doing Christmas special.
Yeah.
So they saw that as a bonus.
Interesting. Collett seemed to use a ton of famous people, didn't they?
Yeah.
I don't know the percentage-wise.
Well, they did.
A lot of the TV were genuinely big, famous people.
But they were actors.
But, yeah.
I mean, you know, when you talk, Eric, one trick is if you've got a sports star who can't act, probably, you know, they're just not actors. And we had James Hunt, who was the world champion, driving for Texaco. So the thing to do is get somebody funny with him
so you can cut away to them.
Or you don't have to stay on him for 40 seconds or something like that. And Eric and Ernie would do the... good morrow, Jane. And James said, it's James. And Eric said, it's the way you walk.
Yeah.
I mean, that was all ad lib.
So was that why that was put together? Because you think James is never going to be able to carry 40 seconds. Let's get someone funny.
And then, absolutely.
Yeah, really.
We did the same with Bailey
on
the Olympus cameras with the wedding photography.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah,
they were marvellous actors, the photographer and the young boy. And Bailey... no, he's a photographer, he's not an actor. So again, you made it funny and he just popped in and out.
He's just got a few reaction shots.
Yeah,
clever. So going back to JWT, you're in the mailroom.
I was.
Is there anything you learnt from the mailroom that stayed with you?
Yes, it is, because there is. I'll tell you what. If you're in the mailroom, you visit every single department in the agency every day. So you take their post round and you get to chat to them, whether it's the creative director or a TV producer, and you chat to them about what they're doing, because they'll chat to the mail, bring them. Yeah. And therefore you learn a lot by doing that from these people. And I think that made me want to get more involved in the ads rather than just keep on taking the post round.
Yeah.
But I remember, I don't know, I was about 17 when I joined, left school. And I remember going to see the head of personnel when I was a junior traffic boy, which meant you took the proofs round, not the mail.
It was very, step up, big
wasn't
step up.
Very stimulating. And I went to see the head of personnel and said to her, Miss Orr, I'd like to be an account executive. And she said, oh, she said, you couldn't possibly aspire to that until you're at least 30.
Oh, really?
So I said, oh, God, blimey, that's a long time. So I packed my bags and left for America because I thought, this is not going to work. I've got to move quicker. And America was doing good work. So I went to America and got a job there.
In an ad agency?
I first of all got a job selling carpets on a store in Fifth Avenue. And I really was a good carpet salesman because that was the time when an English accent was really pretty neat. They all like that. So you come and can I help you, madam? And they said, my God, you're English. Say that again. And so you would have an immediate contact. And I was good at selling carpets, but then I got a...
What was the knack to selling carpets? What's the... What?
I think the knack for selling carpets, if they're coming in to buy a carpet, the knack for it is being charming to them. But it's like...
Ramping up the English accent and being charming.
Absolutely. But it's not... Same as ads.
Yeah.
Same as a salesman doesn't go into a store selling booze or a whatever rack on the door, and the first thing he says, "Madam, this is what you must buy." It sounds. He says, "Good morning. How are you this morning?" And you're on your. I see you've got a couple of children. They come along and say hello, and he talks to them.
Yeah.
And the same with almost anything you do. You have to strike a little bond. And advertising's the same, but not just striking a bit of a bond with a client, if you can do that, so you trust each other, but striking a bond with the consumer so that they enjoy your visit. One of them says, you know, the consumer never asked you to visit their home on their television, so you might make your visit a little more pleasant for doing so, and then they'll listen to you. So I think advertising is the same thing. About being pleasant, and that's why I think we did so many ads that were funny and fun, and people would want to watch them.
So, do you think you carried that from your direct sales experience? So, think you don't, because it's
sure
interesting. People who don't sell would imagine that if you are selling like carpets, it's a much harder in your face thing. That's why many of these ads are just terrible because they've got no, you know, if you're a door to door salesman, you can't, as you say, go straight in. You have to kind of get their defences down. I found out the other day, for example, that people are more receptive to advertising messages when they're half on their computer, half watching TV. And the reason is their defences are down. They're half taking it in. Whereas when you're confronting them full on, they think, I'm not sure about that. Is that true? Whereas...
Well, and if you're confronting them, that's, you don't want to confront... My dad was a salesman on the road. Yeah. He sold duplicating machinery. And I must have learned a lot from him. Because he was a bloody good salesman. I mean, he earned good money from selling duplicating machines and, you know, driving round, calling in on factories and offices and doing the whole thing. You know, should we go out and have a pint and all that kind of thing. And I think that, so I probably did learn that. But I think the other thing, you know, you can have really good accountmen and there can be a major influence on what happens. I mean, I know... I can't remember who it was. I think it was John Salmon, who was our creative director for a long time. He used to call accountmen paid liars.
Right.
I thought, that's not very nice. But you can have a great influence on them. I think I was very lucky being brought up in a pub where you're constantly talking to the people, come in the pub, come in the bar, chatting. Very working class area near, not far from Old Trafford in Manchester, and I left when I was 17 to come to London. But I think you meet a huge swathe of ordinary working class people, and advertising has to talk to them as well, and curious habits that they have. But the thing that is interesting is that I found that Ogilvy said, don't insult the consumer, remember she's your wife. And I do find that certainly politicians, people tend to talk down to, they talk about the public. And there's always a slight disparaging feeling about the public. Whereas I think the public are incredibly smart, clever. They may not have science degrees or maths degrees, but they've got an intuitive understanding of so many things, advertising being one of them. And if you talk to them, people, I remember when we did the Stella Artois campaign, and the client said to me, Frank, all the dialogue is in French. And I said, yes, because it's French. It's actually Belgium, but they speak French. And he said, but the English won't understand it. I said, no. But since the English think that wine and beer and cheese and all those good things come from France, they'll feel comforted by the fact that it's French.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it worked like a dream. I mean, the sales of it. Did Benson Hedge, if you remember the Surreal campaign.
Yeah.
And everybody, I remember John Webster, who I admired enormously, a great pal, lovely man, rang me up the morning that Surreal campaign broke and said, Frank, you finally flipped your lid. But I felt that somehow people would get something from that by, you know, Waldy worked with me and Waldy based it on Magritte.
Yeah.
And I think we'd been to a Magritte exhibition, and the brief I gave to him was, for God's sake, Alan, we must do something that is incomprehensible. Because if it's comprehensible, I won't get it through the code. Because the code has become so impossible. You know, you can't have dialogue, can't smoke smoking, you can't have blue sky, you can't have green fields.
So that was the brief. Something incomprehensible.
I wanted, and I said to him and Duffy, incomprehensible. And they came back, the first photograph they came back was that packed by the mouse hole. And I said, that's it. And when I went down to the authorities and showed them the first few ads, the ad of the bird in the pack in the cage and the bird on the wall, pyramids, and they said, what's it mean? I said, it means absolutely nothing, chaps. And they said, well, how can we judge it? I said, well, you can't. It's just rubbish, really. It's just nothing. So they let it through. But what was interesting was that B&H was a cigarette which always cost a little more than your normal cigarette, because it was pure gold from Benson Hedges. And it was smoked a lot by working class people, particularly in the north, who would buy a pack of B&H going out on a date uptown Saturday evening. So they would have kind of woodbines or whatever during the week because they were cheap, and then put in his suit and tie and go up west with a packet of B&H. And all those people somehow understood what had happened, and the sales doubled in 2 years. And to double the sales of B&H, woof.
Yeah, well, they were very successful before, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I remember Dave Trott saying that when he first saw, because it's always interesting to know what people's first reaction is to these things, because people post-rationalise it when it becomes successful. And his first reaction was, that means nothing. What are they saying? That the B&H is like cheese? You know, he had a very rational thinking, this means nothing at all. This, whereas now people say, oh, it's amazing and it's artful and it's lovely, but
it was a revolutionary campaign. Nobody'd ever done anything like that, and that's why I think Waldy became so loved in the industry, because he had, and the funny thing was, I remember I took it down to the client, the chairman and the chief executive, Hume Stuart Moore and Cameron, and I presented the campaign to them, and they looked at it for a few minutes, and I explained what I was trying to do and the problems I had with the code. And then after a few minutes, they looked and said, well, Frank, that all seems very well. I'd like to have a talk to you about one of our other brands. And we approved it in 5 minutes with no research of any kind. Just pure instinct.
Presumably trust.
Oh, yeah.
Their instinct couldn't have been that's good.
We'd started with Hamlet, of course.
So What's the criteria for judging whether, you know, if you're looking at roughs, and what is the criteria of whether one is good and one is bad?
Well, I've often been asked that, and the problem is, in the end, it is a question of personal judgment. And I know people often say, well, my judgment's just as good as yours, but that isn't true. I mean, there are many people who, I'm sure there are a great many people who couldn't understand Picasso and what he was up to, but certain people saw, who are just smarter at judging art, where he was going and what he was doing. And I think there's something, you look at an advert campaign, and first of all, do you like it? That is very important. Likeability is the most important thing for an ad. If you don't like it, you're not going to watch it again. And it's like meeting somebody in a pub. And if you like them, you'll be pleased to see them again. If you don't, you won't be pleased to see them again. So I think that is very, very important. I think for me, if it's a long-term brand, I always used to ask the creative people to do me the first 2 years advertising so I could make sure that this campaign had what they call legs. In other words, it would certainly run for quite a long time, not just a one-off ad. Too many ads at the moment are just one-off ideas. Yeah. I can't hardly think of many campaigns in the way that, say, Hobbes or Hamlet were, that people genuinely love and want to see more of them. Mm. I mean, there's the good ad for spectacles where that vet is testing a cat, and in fact hits her fur hat. That is one of the few ads that I've really seen that I think's fantastic today, and I've enjoyed that. But a lot of them, so likability, sustainability, on the simple strategy. You know, I used to do a trick if I was doing a presentation, and if you have clients often have too complex a strategy, the research people. And people can't remember all this stuff. You know, you say, well, we've got 5 points we want to get across to the people. And people think, I've got the first one. It's And by the time you've got to five, they've forgotten the lot. And I used to take out a tennis ball, throw it to somebody in the front row, you catch it. Then I'd throw them five, and they'd drop the lot. And I think that's what happens when you're trying to get a strategy across. So every single ad we did was based really on one simple strategy. Stella Artois was reassuringly expensive. Heineken refreshed the parts that other beers could not reach. Happiness was a cigar called Hamlet. And all based on a strong piece of strategic thinking, which in my case I would work out with the creative people. I would work it out. They would work it out. Depending who had the best idea. Didn't use research. Except we used research to find out who used the product, what they felt about the product. We never use research to tell us if the ads were any good.
So it seems, why would you not do it? Because obviously BNP, probably your biggest rivals through the 70s, you seemingly use research all the time, and they did great ads too.
Yeah, well, here's a curious thing. You know, I worked with all of them at Pritchard Wood.
All of them, yeah.
All of them. And two things I can remember. I was working on a new business presentation I was a kind of middleweight executive getting the thing together. And Pollitt, who's a nice man, saw me in the corner and said, Frank, how's that campaign for Vandenberg's, which was Unilever's margarine division, coming? I said, well, to be honest with you, we haven't got the strategy from the planners. And he said, Frank, planning isn't about thinking up the strategy. We can leave that to the creative people. It's about selling it once they've done it.
Pollitt said that.
Pollitt said that. Now, he wouldn't admit it if he was here today, but that's what he really felt. And so I think the fact that planning has become such a vastly important thing in advertising, I'm not sure how beneficial it has been to the quality of advertising. And sometimes I look at advertisements and I can see the planner's been at work. Yeah. You know, you can see the planning in the thing. And certainly at CDP, we didn't have any strategies. We didn't have the planners to give us strategies. Creative people live in the real world. They walk around. They can work out why you should buy it, and we can work. Well, the client can very often be fantastically helpful. What are you trying to do with this product? Talk me, tell me. I remember I went when we were doing the Tesco campaign, and I couldn't find a line. I must have turned down 30 or 40 lines. I was going berserk. And I went to see McLaurin and Terry Leahy and said, look, I can't get this thing right. And I've been at it for 3 months. Now, there's a point, because nobody gives you three months to do anything now. And so tell me again what you're trying to do. And they went through the whole thing again for about an hour. And I listened and asked questions. And I obviously must have still looked worried. And I remember McLaurin put his hand on my arm and said, don't worry, Frank, you'll solve it. And for a client to say that, don't worry, you'll solve it. As opposed to, if you haven't got the solution by next Tuesday, we may have to make other arrangements.
Yeah.
Which is, nobody works in an atmosphere of fear. And I went back, and out of that conversation and the creative people came Every Little Helps.
So what did you see in that early stages? Because often these things look so simple and nothingy in the beginning. It's only the in retrospect you can see how it grows and what's imbued in that line.
But well, it was very, very simple to understand. We worked out, the client knew as well, but we worked out that going shopping on a Saturday is not the most exciting thing in your life. You don't say, whoopee, I'm going to go to the supermarket and spend hours filling my trolley and spending a fortune. It's not a happy event. People quite enjoy it, get their food, but it's not like I'm going to the cinema. So we talked with them, and Tesco, I don't know quite which of us said it first. It doesn't matter. You know, success has many fathers. Mm. But decided to do a whole load of things which would cost them money and would make the shopping experience better. And the client could see they were not doing it for making a profit. They were doing to make shopping easier. So, pregnant women could park near the entrance. Special things for twins. Changing rooms. If there's a queue...
Were they first with all of those?
Yeah.
Were they really?
If there's a queue, you automatically open another checkout. So you can do that. If you get something you don't like, you can take it back and change it. And these were obviously, the consumer could see that all those things were not about making money for Tesco. They were about making your shopping experience easier. And so each ad we did was about one of those things, and this is why we do it, because every little helps. Mm. And every little helps was based only on that strategy. It was not about, we would never run it because it was cheaper, because all supermarkets are cheaper.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, to be absolutely honest with you, I don't know who does Tesco's advertising now, but I think they've gone off that strategy in terms of it's all about price, it's all about this, it's all that. But they still keep Every Little Helps, which was not why Every Little Helps was written at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make it clear?
It's very clear, and I didn't know that. I think
thank
now
God
that,
for that.
I think now they use it in a sense of every little saving helps. Completely the opposite way as
well,
you intended.
Well, that's totally the wrong way. That's not what we... It's like Stella Artois. You remember the line.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well, Stella...
Because I heard you found that in someone's copy.
I found that in Jeff Seymour's
copy.
That's
right, yeah.
We had Stella Artois was made out of female Czechoslovakian hops. Nobody had heard of that. Belgian barley, and matured twice as long as any other beer, which is why it cost more. But I couldn't find a line, and Jeff, I've been trying to get a line to go at the bottom, and I was reading a piece of copy about the story that Jeff had written, and in the middle of the body copy, it said, which is why Stella Artois is so reassuringly expensive. I said, whoopee! And I grabbed the line and stuck it on the bottom, and that's how it came about. So you never know quite how things are going to turn out. You never know. I mean, Hamlet, I went to a Unilever education thing where all these young graduates could go and learn about marketing. And I was giving a talk there, and there was a person speaking before me, and I sat at the back and listened, who then explained how the Hamlet line had come about through planning. And I won't mention his name. And he showed some of the Hamlet ads, and this is how we got to the strategy. And it was my turn to do a talk. And what I intended to do was show work, because in the end, every agent can talk. It's the work that matters. And one of the young students said, "I don't understand this, sir, Frank. You've got a Hamlet ad there, but we've just heard it was done by another agency based on planning. So what's the truth?" I said, "Well..." And he was sitting there. I said, "You naughty chap, you know you didn't do it." And in fact, the Hamlet line was thought up by Tim Warriner, a writer, sitting on the top of a double-deck bus in the days when you could smoke on a bus. Yep. And he came into the agent and said, "I've got the line, Happiness is a Cigar Called Hamlet." And that's how it came about. Pure. No, but the point about creative people is they are creative.
The interesting thing that keeps coming up is when you see these lines, particularly, you go, "That's it."
Yeah, you can spot a good one.
Not everybody can spot a good one.
You could, well, no, but no.
But is it so? Somebody I can't remember who it was, told me that story of the Stella, and they did an impression of you, arching your hand over, saying, "I think that may be our campaign."
It's true.
But it's most people don't do that. Most people might think that's interesting. Let's kind of take that away. Could that be? Couldn't it be? But most people don't say that's it, and it seems like there were more when you tell it there, and when I read about these things, there are much more eureka. That is it. Everybody puts that, because obviously it's a fantastically subjective business.
You name me now the base lines for campaigns running at the moment.
Yeah, might need to get back to you on that.
No, well, that's the point. A line should be memorable. From the beginning, it should have charm and wit. And you can spot it. I mean, wonderful example of, we were doing a campaign for Unilever on a soap powder. And we had this idea, which was, what's his name? The writer. Wonderful writer. That, because washing powder ads were all about how white the clothes got. And you held them up to the light and said, "Look." And we thought, why don't we do a campaign about how it's all right to get dirty if you're a kid.
Yeah.
And so we wrote this campaign. I took it down to Unilever, showed it to them. The marketing manager was a little nervous. Chief executive, Niall Fitzgerald, said, "That's pretty good, actually, Frank. I like that." And it had a line at the bottom. The first ad we did was a boy on a beach crawling along the sand next to a turtle. And the turtle was crawling along the sand, and they had this nice relationship. Bizarre thought. But, of course, in doing all that, the boy got very dirty. And when he went home, he was filthy. And his mother looked at him, and the line was, "It's the dirty kids that shine." Now, the idea of that was, in order to succeed as a child, as you grow up, you may have to occasionally get dirty. It's not all about looking spotless.
Yeah.
And I thought, the dirty kids that shine, and that means you'll shine as you grow up. And I love that line. I left it alone. Several months later, I found the campaign was done by another agency with the line, "Dirty's good." And I thought, well, that's not a very good line. Not as good as "It's the dirty kids that shine." So I think most people, but then you can spot it. But then, you know, we always had John Salmon who would look at a line. Colin Millwood, who was very fierce.
What should I ask you about Colin?
And also, you know, if you've got Alan Parker shooting them or Ridley shooting them, they have a contribution to make as well. And Frank, that's really not very good. And I remember Alan sometimes said, "I can't shoot that, Frank. It's just not right. There's something wrong with it." So you've got these wonderful directors who are coming in to make a contribution. But because they're so good, creative people will listen to them. Oh, that's interesting, Alan.
You've got a whole chain of trust there that absolutely doesn't exist anymore. So from you to the client, from the creatives to you, creatives to the director, everybody's seems to be open to other people's suggestions.
They do.
If a director now says, "I'm not sure I could shoot that," they go, "Okay, thanks very much." And they find someone else, then
they possibly would. But you see, I think one of the problems there that's happened is that, when, let's say, Ridley was doing a commercial for us, and have a little meeting with the creative people, Ridley, myself, He'd talk about how he saw it. They'd talk, and then I'd say, fine. They might, if they wanted to, show me the casting, but not always, you know. I mean, I remember Alan came up. Do you remember Penelope Keith in the Parker Pen?
Yes, brilliant. Yeah.
Well, Alan chose Penelope because I said, we've got to cast it. He said, well, Penelope Keith will be wonderful in this, and of course she was. But you get a situation where I wouldn't see anything until Ridley brought back the first cut. I wouldn't see the editing, I wouldn't see the footage, I wouldn't see anything. And he would come back with the first cut, and then we'd have a chat about normally how to cut it down a bit, since however long the commercial was, Ridley'd shot more. Mm-hmm. So if it's a 60, it came in as a 75. I haven't booked 75s, Ridley, can we? But because, you know, directors, they don't like to leave their babies on the floor,
no,
do they? They just don't like doing that. But nowadays, for still photography or commercial, it's all being shown in the studio while they're filming it.
Yeah.
And the clients can make comments. I remember that Ridley, again, we were shooting a commercial, and the client came to, I think it was Ridley, or was it Alan, somebody, and the client said, I'm a bit worried about that. And when he'd said it three times, I thought, I know, he wasn't right, and he was a good client, but he had a bee in his bonnet about something. So I went over to Ridley, I said, Ridley, and Ridley said, and Ridley then said to the client, why don't you come on over and have a look at the shot? This is very naughty, you know. And the client came over, and Ridley lined the shot up, and if nothing else, by God, he was a bloody good cameraman, wasn't he? I mean, fantastic in the lighting. And he said, Frank, what do you... No, said to the creative people, what do you think? And they looked at the thing. Oh, I think that'll work, Ridley. Yeah, I think that's good. Mate, Frank, what do you... Oh, I think that's very good. And he said, would you like to have a look? He said, I'd love to. And he shut the thing off. And then, oh, that's very good.
Oh, really? How embarrassing.
That was very naughty. That was very naughty. But then it was funny. And I told the client afterwards, I said, you know what he did to you? And I said, you know what he did? He said, client said, God, I am such a clot. I should have realised.
So he just, was he too embarrassed
he was
to
too
say?
Embarrassed to say, I can't see it.
Can't see it, so he said, oh, it looks great. Fine.
But so if you can see every shot, you leave Bailey to choose the three or four pictures he wants to bring in and show you. Not go through everything, and then the client goes through everything. You're paying, I don't know, what are you paying? Directors, 20,000 a day or something. Photographers, 10,000, 15,000, a lot of money. Why the hell would you want to tell them how to do it? I don't understand that. But you could say the same about ad agencies. Yeah. Why would the hell would you tell ad agencies who you're paying all that money to how to do it? But there you are.
So I'm going to ask you a question a bit further back.
Yeah.
So I thought it was sort of interesting and ironic that you were at Lintas, because that must be the complete opposite of CDP.
Yeah.
And you're on Frozen Foods. I used to work with someone, funny enough, who used to work with you at Lintas in my first job, and he would tell me about you in a pink corduroy suit.
Yeah.
But he would say it as if you were running down the street naked. It was like such a crazy thing. I don't know why he thought it was so crazy that you would wear a pink corduroy suit to work. So I'm putting together a few of these things. So you'd wear a pink corduroy suit at the time, which was obviously very unusual that someone would be telling me 30 years later.
I got it from.
Take Six.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I remember those. You were in a commercial at Pritchard Wood.
Won a Gold Lion.
Yeah.
At Cannes.
It's a very good performance. Very understated.
Performance.
In a modern understated way. You didn't move much.
No, I didn't. You know why I got that job?
No.
I was sitting with Lee Lacey when they were doing a casting session. I wandered along to have a chat to them afterwards. I was sitting there and suddenly Lee said, Frank, you're going to do it. You look so bored, and that's what we want.
Oh, really?
And that's how I got the...
Was that John Webster's commercial? Or
yes.
National,
yes.
Provincial?
Yeah.
And then, famously from that period, I think this is right, you managed to sell the girl trying to hold herself from doing a wee.
That was great.
Instead of it being a 60, it was a 67 or something.
It was 74, which didn't exist.
Right.
And
how did you sell that?
Oh,
the question was... At that point, you must have been making a name for yourself that you're doing things slightly differently. You're in a commercial, which must be helpful within our small business. You're wearing these crazy, supposedly crazy suits, and then you manage to sell a time slot that didn't exist.
Well, to start with on that, the whole thing is trust. And if you persuade the client to run a campaign and it's good and it works and his next door neighbour says, I like your new ads for so-and-so, he feels comfortable. So then when you bring the next one along, he thinks, oh, that's all pretty good. I'll have a go with that. And slowly as an agent, you build up this thing where the clients trust you to do great advertising. And therefore, they're not there sitting, I wonder what's wrong with this. They're sitting there, I'm looking forward to seeing this. So that is that element of trust. Conversely, never go to a client with a campaign you don't believe in. Because if you do, to start with, he'll see it. He'll see it in your eyes. He'll see you're trying to sell him something you don't really believe in. And then, when he tells you it's no good, and you say, you know, you're right, it's no good, you're lost. Because when you bring the next one, well, why isn't this one no good either? He said the last one was the bee's knees. So that is a very important thing. Don't go to clients with things that aren't good.
But at what point did you have a say in what you went to clients with? Because presumably when you were a young account guy, you weren't choosing what you...
I think when I started to work with Webster and a man called Brian Mandel, was the writer, Webster was an art director. And I started to work with them, and what happened was that I started to sell some of their work because, well, I started to take it to the client, said, let me, agency, and the client would buy it. And shortly thereafter, they began to trust me to sell the work. And that's the point at which all creative people want is an account person who can spot a good ad and even if not, can appreciate that it's good and sell it. That's what an account man is for. He is not there to rewrite the copy. He is not this. When the copy comes in, Brignall was my favourite writer, fantastic writer. He brings the copy in, and I used to say, thanks, Tony, for a campaign. I say, can you leave it with me? And he'd say, yeah. I said, because I look forward to reading his copy so much that I would keep it on the desk, and when everybody had gone home, I'd sit quietly for an hour just for the sheer pleasure of reading his construct of words. And it was such a joy. Now, somebody comes in with and I've met many account men and many clients, but when you say this is the body copy, they automatically take a pencil out of their pocket just to knock it into a shape with a few good thoughts. I remember one saying, what are you doing with that pencil? He said, well, I just might make a few. I said, listen, Sir John Salmon spent a month writing this copy, and he's one of the three or four best writers in England. How do you think you can knock it into shape? And yet, as I said in an article I did recently, show me a good ad, I'll show you a good client. Mm. So a client is vital. I have the hugest respect for them. You remember Simmons Gooding?
Yeah, I was going to ask
him. He was fantastic.
Well, that brings me back to the Lintas thing, which I guess I didn't really explain, which is that I would have thought the worst place to go if you want a job at college, which presumably you did because it was the best place in London at the time, would be Lintas. Wow. And ironically, because you then had frozen food experience, that led you to getting a job at college.
That's why I went to Lintas.
Was it?
Bozeman see me polish.
I didn't realise it was premeditated.
Started the agency. And to my horror, they didn't ask me to join. Now, they didn't
Why
ask
was
me
that,
to,
do you think?
Well, I think one was because there was an account director, who ran the Cadbury's account, and the Cadbury's account was going to move with them. So they had the man who ran the Cadbury's account to move with them, and they only had that one account, so it wasn't really a job for them. Although, to his credit, Webster said, you're wrong, you should get Frank. And I like Martin very much. I'm still friends with him, a very nice man. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? Pritchard Wood was destroyed, but because they left. They wanted to buy some of the shares back from Interpublic, and Interpublic refused, so they left. Foolish mistake. Yeah. And then I thought, where shall I go? I know, I'm going to get some packaged goods experience, because I haven't got any, and the best place to get packaged goods experience, if not for the advertising, at least for the experience, is Lintas, which was Lever International Advertising Service, and that's what they were. And I worked there for about, I suppose, a year.
And how was that? Was that hell?
It wasn't hell, because I shared an office, or I had an office next door to Sony Simmons Cudding, who eventually became my friend and my client for 30 years. But it was just you couldn't get any ads out. It was also boring, the ads. I mean, they were definitely what John Salmon used to call 2CK advertising. Yeah, yeah. And we can't say that on
there.
Yeah,
I know what those C's were. Yeah.
And there were people watching. Oh, look, how wonderfully taught this. And it was just awful. You know, if it was for a coffee or something, we would have the in-cup satisfaction shot where, and I couldn't bear it. And eventually, I couldn't get them to react to anything, which is why, eventually, I wore that famous pink suit. I thought, this will get a reaction. And I walked in and I went into this big Unilever meeting with the managing director of the ANC and the Unilever in a pink suit. And the managing director said, bit strong, Frank, bit strong. So I thought, this is hopeless. Now, I was sharing a flat with a lovely man called Vernon Howe.
Yeah.
And Vernon said, listen, come to Collett's, because he was working as an art director at Collett's. And so I went to Collett's. I went for an interview.
To work on a pitch for Birdseye, was it? Initially?
I worked on a pitch for Birdseye, and Collett's didn't have any packaged goods experience because it was all about cigarettes, cigars, fashion, Harvest Bristol cream, all that lot of nice things. They didn't have that.
Were you interviewed by Colin Millwood or Collett? No,
I was interviewed by a man called Geoffrey Patty, who later went on to become an MP. And I have to say, what convinced me, apart from anything else, to take the job, I wanted the job anyway, but I was going to be paid £5,000 a year, and they offered me, in the offer letter, an extra £500. They put it up, not down.
Right.
Well, I thought, this is a bit of luck, eh? It really is a bit of luck. So that would, although I had a wonderful, my first encounter with the creative department there was with dear Alan Parker. And people had gone up to see him. He was a writer then, worked with Paul Windsor. And he was obviously the new star on the block. And they said, you're going to hate this new account man. And he said, he's got opinions. I'll sort that out, thought Alan. He'll tell you the story as well. And a few days later, I went up to see him, dressed entirely in black, from head to foot. And I introduced him. I said, why are you dressed entirely in black? You look like Lash LaRue. I said, Alan, it is the anniversary of the Manchester United air crash. I always dress in black for the anniversary. So Alan, he can't be that bad after all, even though Alan's a fanatical Arsenal fan.
Yeah.
So that, but I felt so comfortable with them all. I felt excited about what they do. I mean, I could remember the famous story of Terry and the Heineken refreshes the parts line and how he wrote that in the middle of the night, having sneaked off to North Africa for a shoot for Ford. But when he came back with half a dozen lines, I could see immediately.
Well, again, it's
that's
the same
a
thing.
Good line, and so it turned out to be.
So how did you find Colin Millwood? Because it's interesting for me, Colin Millwood, that when I got into the business in '85, nobody knew him, and obviously nobody knows him now.
No.
But the people who did know him say he's the most important man in advertising.
If you asked Alan or Putnam,
we'd
all say Colin was a lot of our mentor. He's a miserable Yorkshireman, like Neil Godfrey. They're all black. You know, they say about how do you get a yard of copper wire? And the answer is drop a penny between the Scott brothers. he was, and he was picked his teeth and moaned. But he taught me the one most important thing he taught me was, you can't accept anything that is mediocre. And that is one of the problems today. Nobody's got time to write things. I'm not sure how many great creative people there are, like Abbott or Webster. And so you probably get quite good advertising. And it's the old story about the good's the enemy of the great. Good isn't good enough. And it just isn't. And Colin, I watched Colin. He used to sit in the corner of his office for hours watching work coming in and out.
You would?
Yeah, I sat there. And he would turn it down if it wasn't good enough. And I have to tell you, he was pretty brusque. He was very brusque. I remember a copywriter had written an ad for Ford, which was sitting on his desk, and he was looking at it, looking displeased. And he had said to the office manager, Laurie, who wrote this? He said, it was Judy. And he said, ask her to have the goodness to step down. And I thought, this isn't going to be nice. So Judy, who was a tough Yorkshire girl, you know, she wasn't going to put up with any crap from that misogynist Millward, tapped on the door and said, Colin said, come in, don't sit down. She said, did you want to see me, Joyce? He said, it's Judy. He said, I'm sure it is, Joyce. And then he looked at the ad and he turned it round. He said, does this ad have to look quite so awful? Go away and try again. And unfortunately, although that was Colin was pretty brutal, we admired him because he had the courage to say no and the courage to say yes and support it when it was good. And he knew. He knew. He was an art director originally. He turned into a rather good painter. Mm. But you can't be afraid of saying what you think. I remember creative people. Dad, who was it? One of them. I can't remember who it was. One of the writers. Six of them came to see me because I'd turned down a campaign they liked. And they came to see me. And after about 20 minutes, I said, well, I hear what you say, but I still can't take it to the client. I really don't like it and I can't believe I can sell it because he'll know I don't like it. So they said, I said, could we all try again? So they all went out and somebody said to one of them, how did you go with Frank? He said, he ganged up on us.
I've heard that. Yeah.
Have you heard that
I
story?
I've heard that.
So
he ganged
it's a
up
true
on us,
story.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
So was that was at college?
That was at college, yeah.
So what did you take from Colin? You know, what did he teach you? It's interesting sitting in the room while he's essentially beating up these different creatives
that
who come in.
That was one thing. He taught me to value type.
Yeah.
Which I think is extremely important. You know, if you have a long-term print campaign, you shouldn't have to see the brand. You should know it is from the type.
And he was very big on that.
Oh, he was very keen on that. He taught me about photography and the importance of getting great photographers. Now, how lucky was I? How lucky were we all? Bailey, Donovan, Duffy, Snowden,
Avedon.
Penn, Avedon.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, it was remarkable to get all this work done by people who are now legends.
How did you, as an account man, get their bill signed off? I was thinking, how would you get some of these scruffy little English companies to use Richard Avedon and Irving Penn? Presumably people are flying over there in those days.
They were, and we used to have
how
those
did they
terrible
afford that?
C-types, you remember?
Yeah.
Retouched, retouched in America. I don't know. I think the person who started that was Colin, in terms of...
Art Kane, he used to use, it was amazing, yeah.
Wonderful. I think he started that, but you could see the difference between a photograph by Penn and a photograph by Penn. Who was Sandbank, the great his still lifes of food were so wonderful compared with ordinary still lifes of food. And therefore, it was worth, bearing in mind, you may be spending, I don't know, those days on print campaign, 200,000 or 300,000, which is a lot of money. It might be worth spending, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 or 10,000 on getting all the photography right. And it was. And I look through the Times today, you know, the colour magazines.
Yeah.
I very rarely see any photograph that may go, why? And if it is, it's normally editorial.
Hmm.
I see there's an exhibition just open of Don McCullen's work.
Yeah.
Well, Don's work was fantastic, a wonderful man. He's been ill. I'm sad to see he's better. But, I mean, this was just a remarkable photographer, not just for his war photography. I mean, I've got several photographs in the house at home of Don's.
Have you? Yeah,
yeah, which is one of them, which I love, which is two nannies walking a babies in Hyde Park in those wonderful high prams, you know. I mean, so you can't, people can't say, well, it's all a matter of opinion. You know what's a good photograph. You do. They do. Everybody does. You can see it, and it stands out.
But it's hard. It's a tough job to get other people to go along with you and agree with you, and then write the check for twice as much or three times.
No,
as
that's
much.
Perfectly true. And I remember on B&H when we were doing the campaign, Duffy had done the original work, and I said to Alan, we're still looking like the original campaign. There's a lot of russet, and there's a lot of brown, and there's a lot of, you know, that kind of pure gold, the original campaign.
Yeah.
And by then I'd spent 20,000 on Duffy. And I went to the client and said, I'm afraid we're going to have to throw it all away.
What, speculative or doing tests?
No, the client knew I was doing it.
But they were doing tests.
Yeah. And I said, I'm going to have to throw it all away, and I've wasted £20,000 of your money. And the client said, well, at least you're honest enough to tell me, as opposed to trying to make me buy something you don't believe in. And we went back and started all over again with Waldy and Duffy. And
so 20,000 now, that's 150,000?
Yeah, probably. Probably. Probably.
So again, you have to have a pretty good relationship to say, we're going to have to write off that 150,000. So again, it comes back to trust. And
I'm sure you would felt, if you interviewed Charlie Saatchi, who I worked, he worked at Bentham Bowles with me in the early days.
Did you work with him there?
Yeah, and
with John
Hegarty
as well.
Good writer. Charlie was a very good writer. But I'm sure if you said to Charlie, how did you get the money to make those British Airways films with Hugh? I'm sure they cost a fortune. And yet, they proved to be worth the money. And once you've done one, and it's worked, and everybody's saying to the client, well done, that's a fantastic ad, as opposed to not mentioning the ad at all.
Yeah.
Then he has the confidence to do another one. It's all confidence and belief, this kind of thing, and good people, and good people, and more good people. I mean, I used to look at every ad virtually done by Bose, by did Abbott, you? By Saatchi. Hegarty did some very good work. And now, who's written that, and who's written that? And should I try and steal them? Because it's a creative work, and that's why I've always spent my life trying to promote creative work, creative people. It's a precious commodity, good creative work, and it is not to be sneered at if you've got good people. It's not to be said, well, like at college we never ever briefed five teams to do a campaign. One was the order of the day.
And why was that?
Because five teams won't think, first of all, they won't get themselves into the situation. I am responsible for doing this wonderful work. I'm not, and they would really feel a pressure of responsibility, which pushed them to doing work. Second thing is, what are you going to do? Take five campaigns to the client and ask him to choose? Well, that's abrogating your responsibility, isn't it? I mean, client came to you to choose. But a lot of agents, they watch the client. And as soon as they see him hovering near one, that's the one we liked.
I had an interesting lesson on that. The single team with a lot of time. So I used to work at Liga Stellini.
And at good the time, man.
At the time, Tim. We were given briefs. Like Tim would come in and say, we need something in 6 hours. I mean, ridiculous. Then things are a bit more like that now, but ridiculous. So you get used to doing things quickly. And in a way, it was like less stressful, because you think, well, I'll do what I can in 6 hours.
That's right.
It's less stressful. And I went to see my friend who was working at Lowe's, Alistair Wood, who was working on, I think he was working on the brief for a Stella commercial. He had 6 weeks. It's the only thing he had on. Absolutely going out of his mind. So it was interesting that I was there. I probably had two briefs to do that day. He was there. He was in his fourth week of one brief. His eyes were on stalks. Because you have no excuse. It has to be the best thing ever done.
And probably he came up with something very good. I don't know who wrote what, but which ads.
Yeah.
And Jeff wrote the original campaign, Jeff Seymour. But He probably did. There was wonderful. Have you seen the Stellar advertising now? It's absolutely awful, frankly. I don't normally criticise other people's work because they get upset. But it is a terribly disappointing ending to what... I mean, we built Stellar. It was selling 40,000 barrels when Whitbread asked me to do the advertising, asked Collett to do the advertising. And by the time I'd gone, they were selling 4 million barrels.
Wow.
I mean, it was the success, biggest selling brand in Britain. All really because it was a good product, good advertising. And people would, if you say, it's called Stella Artois. Cool, that's a funny name for a beer, isn't it? But their naming is odd. I remember when they were doing the Hamlet campaign, and the agency had to come up with a new cigar. That time, cigars were very popular if they were Dutch. You may remember things like Schimmelpenninck.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had lots of fancy lettering and gold medals on the front. So we did one that was called Prince Rupert.
Yeah.
And there was the pack.
Made up the brand?
Yeah.
Prince Rupert.
Yeah. And we showed it. The client said, that's really good. He said, however, unfortunately, we won't be doing that. We've registered the name Hamlet and we've registered the pack and here it is.
Right.
So, things are odd.
Yeah.
The thing is, there's no certain way of getting to where you might want to be. There's no certain way. And just pushing it, pushing it, pushing it.
So why do you think, pretty soon after you joined Collett's, within 3 years, you were MD?
Oh, that's because Pierce had a heart attack.
But why did they choose you, do you think?
Pierce chose me.
Did he? Why would that be?
I think because Pierce and Millwood felt that as an account man I showed promise in selling the work and working with the creative people. I mean, those were the days after the war and adorable, wonderful people there they were. Met a lot of people in advertising at Collett's and Thompson. They came out of the army. They were demobbed and they were all from the guards and this, that and the other. Nigel Clark, who was account director on Hovis, Richie, the account director on Gala, jolly good chaps and that kind of thing. But I don't think they saw them as...
So you were nothing like any of the
other
generation?
No, I wasn't. But give them credit, or not credit as the case may be, when Pierce announced that me at the age of 31 was going to be managing director, they all supported me. There was no jealousy of any kind in the agency. At least I don't think there was, I can't be sure.
And how did you... Did you feel instantly comfortable in that role, or
no?
How did you feel being in charge of all of these ex-brigadiers and journal,
all these nutters? I don't know. I can't remember really. It was a big surprise to me, and I just got on with it. But I can't remember how I felt particularly. Very exciting.
What was your goal taking over at that point? Because it was the
my goal
was 74.
Yeah, a bit earlier. 71, I think.
Oh, was it?
72. It was to make Collett's, which it already was becoming, the best agency in the world. Even better than Doyle Dane in America, because everybody talked about Doyle Dane. I had such a miserable bugger he was. I liked him. Bill, I got to know quite well, Birnbach, because of... Pierce was a great friend of his. And in New York, we would have lunch a couple of times. And then from then on in, every time I went to America... I went to see Bill Birnbach. He'd chat to me. Right. We might have a spot of lunch because I had such admiration for him. And I used to take the CDP reel, which in latter years had got much better. I mean, we know that from the amount of awards it won around the world. It got much better than the Doyle Dane reel. But they couldn't ever... great advertising. It was all done in
New
York.
They couldn't see it, yeah.
Yeah. And so I'd take my reel, put it in my bag... Go and see Bill, have lunch. Before lunch, Bill would always say, Frank, do you want to come and see the latest reel? Oh, I'd love to, Bill. So we'd go there, creative director, Bill, look at the reel. And I was itching for him to say, have you got any of your work? He never did, and he never saw it. And I was too embarrassed. Say, would you like to see our work, Mr. Birnbach?
Really?
Yeah.
God.
And he just didn't notice. Now, Mary Wells, totally the opposite. Mary thought British advertising was fantastic.
Did she really?
Mm.
It's funny, have you read her book?
Yes, I have read her book. Yes, A Big Life, yeah. I know Mary very well. She's very old now.
Is she?
Yeah. But I knew Mary very well. And when I'd seen Bill, the next day I went to see Mary. And I must say, the first time Mary said, have you brought a reel? And I said, I have, Mary. So she put it on and looked at it. And when I'd left, she said, can you leave it with me? She got the creative department together at Wells Rich Green and said, now look at this reel from London, CDP. It's better than ours. So there was a difference between her kind of... She's a nice woman. I like Mary very much indeed. I mean, there were very great... I thought Chiat was fantastic, Jay.
Yeah.
Wonderful, imaginative man from his offices to his work.
Yeah.
I liked him very much. And, of course, Lee Clow, who was his...
Yeah, he's amazingly...
Wonderful art director. I only met Lee a couple of times. He was very quiet and secretive.
Was he?
He wasn't... a personality at the awards and that kind of thing, but he was wonderful. I mean, he responsible for the Apple ad for a start, so we can...
There's a really interesting book about Bill Bavlak by... what's it called?
Levinson.
No, it's a sort of almost unknown book by someone there. Paints
about
a
Bill?
Very different picture of him. Shocking.
I've not read
so
it.
So I've got a copy. I'll send you a copy of it. But it paints a very different picture than the one that everybody else paints of him being very saintly. It's by someone, I think it was like his secretary or someone, being much more insecure and much more worried that his name wasn't on the work, and it's and the sort of internal politics of what was happening. It's quite interesting.
Really?
Yeah. And I've interviewed a few people from DDB New York from that period, like Len Sirowitz and things, and they weren't aware of it. They read it and are often surprised at some of the things in there.
Well, it's like Millwood's name wasn't on any of the work, but we all knew his spirit was on the work.
So did you go to... There was a story I heard where when the new B&H campaign was about to up, you took him to campaigns and talked to him about it.
I took him. I was very nervous about this campaign. It had broken every rule in the book, and I was sitting in my office with it. Finally got it ready for presentation. I couldn't... Salmon said, Frank, I have no idea what you and Waldy are up to. But then Salmon was a writer.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'll just do something. So I rang, got hold of Colin in Minorca, said, Colin, do me a favour. There's a plane ticket in 3 hours' time to London. Come to London. Come and see me at my home. We'll have a bit of dinner. And then in the morning, I want to show you a campaign I've done with Waldy, and I'll make you breakfast, and I put it, and the next morning I put it all around the room, all the ads, breakfast. And I said, what do you think? He said, Frank, he said, it's fantastic, but be careful, you may have two campaigns here. One is where it is totally surreal and has no meaning, and one is where you replace an object with a pack of Benson Hedges. That is not surreal. So make sure you don't go in that direction, go in that direction.
Oh, well.
And the car came, took him to the airport, he flew back. Nobody knew he'd been. But it gave me the confidence to try and sell something that was absolutely outrageous at the time. And I didn't know the client was going to approve it in 5 minutes.
So some of them initially weren't replacing the pack?
No, there was a pack in the birdcage an image of the bird on the wall, which is...
Yeah.
There was the mouse hole, which is ridiculous advertisement.
Ring, I think there was the ring. The ring was one of the early ones.
That's right. The one I was doubtful about, which became very famous, but it did actually replace something with a pack, was the pyramids.
Right.
But Neil and Tony did that, but I thought it was such a striking image, we should run it anyway.
What made you doubtful about that?
Because it's not surreal. You can see it. You can understand. Ah, they have replaced a pyramid with a Benson Hedges pack on its side, like that. Whereas the other ones, you'd think, what the hell is that?
Yeah. Interesting.
So,
So, I happened to read a thing about the making of that pyramid ad. And, A, that would be done in a studio in 20 minutes now. It looked terrible, but that's the way they would do it. And the team was sent to, where is it, Cairo? Where are the pyramids?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Sent A to do it for real rather than buy a stock shot. Which
that's
is
right.
Then they turned up to get a view of it, thought, that's fine, we'll come back in the morning. The next morning, it was covered in smog. They waited a week because all the factories in the week were pumping out smog. So they waited a week. Whole crew and team for I think it was the Monday or the Sunday when all the smog died down. You think that's just no chance of anything like that happening to take the shot.
Well, we seem to have a bit of that kind of luck on B&H. You know the story of the film, the famous Hugh Hudson film with the iguanas and all that. And the only place we could guarantee desert and weather was Arizona. So everybody went to Arizona, and near where they shot, can't remember, good film. Anyway, it rained.
In Arizona.
For a week. Never have rain, and they have flash floods there, because they don't have drains, because they don't have rain. So we were up to our, kind of halfway up to our knees in water in the hotel. Nobody could shoot, and every day I rang my account man in London, Julian Seaman, and said, Julian, we can't shoot. Would you go and tell the client it's going to cost another $12,000 to sit here? And he'd come back and say, she says that's all right. And this went on for a week. So we're now over £100,000 and not a film button turned. And in the end, he came back one day and he said, Frank, they've asked you not to ring anymore about this. Just finish the film and bring something wonderful back. They can't keep discussing it. And of course, they brought that extraordinary film back, which was Hugh really wonderfully shot.
That's amazing.
I remember there's a snake in that. Do you remember that strikes? He's striking, and Hugh's behind the plate glass, looking at the snake, and they're not nice snakes.
No.
And this was a rattlesnake, and I am well away from that area, gazing down from a little bank behind, looking at that kind of thing. And he got the shot. It's a wrap. Move next setup. And the snake man said, "Hang on, everybody. Has anybody seen the other rattlesnake?"
Oh my God!
By God, I mean, film crews are not known for their speed. God, did they move that day? Really fantastic. And it was a groundbreaking film.
Yeah.
In every way.
I can remember seeing that at the cinema when I was very young. And it was like nothing you'd seen. Yeah. The music was
people used to
strange.
Clap.
Yeah.
We don't have. Now, I mustn't say that because Martin Sorrell said, "It's all right for you, Frank. You look at advertising through rose-tinted glasses." And I said, "And Martin, you only look at advertising through a pound note." He said, "You're quite right, Frank. We are different."
Well, it's funny. It reminds me of the Fiat commercial, which was also...
That was another nightmare.
Another... Why are these things all so problematic? And they're all some of the best ads ever.
Yeah.
Fiat,
yeah.
B&H posters and TV. They've all got these problems attached to them
in the Fiat
making. I don't know. What was that, a factory strike?
And somebody was shot. Killed.
Oh, were they? Really?
The marketing manager was shot and killed on the steps of the factory. About
the marketing manager?
Yeah. About a couple of weeks before. I don't know why him, but he was. So we go in to shoot the first... Hugh again. Written by Wayland and Horry. And I'd sent them up all the news footage I could find on this new car, and they'd seen a thing about how it was made by robots in Turin. Said, "We'll do a film about robots. Nobody's ever done that."
Wayland and Horry said that.
Yeah, they said, "So let's..." And they said, so he came in and said, "Look at this bit of film, Frank. We'd like to do a film like about the robots and how they make it." Now, Ogilvy said, of course, "If the client proves refractory, show the picture of his factory." "Only in the gravest faces should you show your client's faces." But we went down there, and of course they were on strike. So we sat there for 2 or 3 days thinking, what should we do? And then I had a bright idea. Why don't we get a helicopter to take us over the factory inside where they have a track?
Yeah, around the roof.
Yep. And I rang the client and said, "Well, this is what we're going to do." He said, "Are you mad?" And so he said, "You'll be killed if you do that. I can have no doubt you'll be shot by the strikers. This is the Red Brigade, and they will do you. So sit where you are." Eventually we got in the factory, and Hugh shot that wonderful.
While the strike was outside?
Yeah, the strikers were outside, but they smuggled all of us in the middle of the night. And we were in the factory, nobody but the robots and the crew, and one or two supervisors who could make them all work. And shot the film. Couldn't shoot the track. We had to, which was the ending, you know, when they're going round and they climb onto a transporter. We went had to go to Paris to shoot that on a track there. I think the music was wonderful.
So it's interesting. I talked to Paul Weiland about this, and when he explained the idea and how it came about, it sounded ludicrous. I mean, it's an amazing a gold, and it was an amazing different thing. Yeah. So he said he had the footage. The car was called at the time Rizzo, I think.
That's
it was.
Right, yes.
He thought that sounded a bit like Figaro. Which you think?
I didn't know that.
Do you not?
No, so I didn't
know
that.
So he said, I thought Rizzo, that sounds a bit like Figaro, where they have that opera. So I thought, well, that doesn't really sound like Figaro to me. But anyway,
doesn't sound anything like Figaro.
He said, so we thought, well, let's get a version of Figaro. He said, then they changed the name of the car. So I said, well, didn't you think you'd have to change? Well, not really, we just got used to it and we liked it. And then we had footage of this thing. I thought, God, that sounds like a recipe for a disaster. There's like, so it's that music because it sounded like what the car was initially called, but they changed the name.
I didn't know that myself. No. I do remember that we eventually, when we'd finished shooting in the factory, by that time there was a lot of anger outside, and they managed to get us out some back route because they'd set fire to some tyres round the factory to stop us getting out. I mean, this is hysterical things you do. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether these kind of things go on now, but that was hysterical. Then we shot the end, and the client, now here's a client. Now that commercial, even though the factory was already there, cost a lot of money. I mean, it was days.
What was the cost? The cost in closing the factory?
I think probably in those days, probably 300,000 to 400,000, something like that.
Why was it so expensive? Helicopters?
Helicopters, moving to Paris, waiting to shoot, a big crew. It was just expensive to shoot. I mean, I didn't get involved in the production companies do that, don't they?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I didn't get involved. This is what it's going to, and that, and the TV producer. I have great admiration for TV producers.
Yeah,
we had wonderful ones, Alan Marshall in particular, of course, but great admiration for them. But the client had not seen anything. And the launch of the car was in Venice at the Lido. And there were, I think, something like 600-700 Fiat dealers there. And Agnelli came down to speak to the troops before the launch, and Agnelli's visiting was a big deal for everybody there. And the client was so bad, I said, I'll have it with me. I'm flying down tonight, today. I'll show it you tonight. This is the night before the conference. He'd seen nothing.
Agnelli?
No, the client.
The client, not even the client.
The marketing manager, seen nothing. Thanks. And I went into where we were going to show the thing the next day. It was quiet. I put it on. And he showed it, and he turned to me, and he put his arms around me, and there were tears running down his face, and he said, thank you so much. Please tell everybody it's wonderful.
Amazing.
Well, whoever listening to this, if anybody is, may find that over-sentimental. But I don't find that over-sentimental. People have worked for months to try and get this special thing. It was 2 minutes long.
Mm. Whole ad break, wasn't it?
Got Mike Yersh and the media director to be the first person ever to buy the centre break at News at 10, the whole centre break, because I wanted that, because I've always been suspicious of, if you're not first in break and first in break is crap, then you've lost your audience. They've gone off for a pee or to make a cup of tea by the time your ads gets on. So we bought the first in break, and I remember seeing, oh, that's a good job, what do we do next?
So when you first saw that script, is that on a basic level thinking robots? I bet the people in that pub in Manchester where I used to be, I bet I can imagine them.
No, they didn't show
me
a script.
What did they show you?
They showed me the footage.
Oh, okay. So
they showed me that and said, we want to make a film about the robots, and we'll go away and sit with Hugh and work out what he will film and how each robot works and that kind of thing. And I left it at that. I didn't get involved.
But you thought that could be interesting. It's unusual. Or what did you?
I thought
Because it's when it all comes together, it's amazing.
That was first, and they had that line, remember, Handmade by Robots, great, yeah. Which was a really good line. Yeah. And I thought, well, nobody's ever done this before. And nobody's ever showed that that cars now are made by robots. Nobody'd seen that before. They'd heard a bit about it. And this will be fascinating to everybody. And it was.
Yeah.
It absolutely was. I mean, I remember, because they used to measure recall in those days, and we only had enough money, I think, for... I think it was, you know what we call opportunities to see, each person should see this ad with a fair wind this many times. Yeah. This was three times, and we had 70% recall in this country. People had only seen it three times. I mean, and that's the real reason, like British Airways. If you do ads like that, you don't need to keep repeating them all the time, because, as I said to you about the man in the pub, if he's boring, he's boring. Yeah. You don't. It doesn't matter if you beat him 40 times.
Yeah, yes. So were you? So one thing chronologically, I probably should have mentioned. Obviously, Colletts did Ford, famously fired it when nobody did.
I remember going up there with the letter.
Were you were involved in the firing of?
Oh,
Ford.
Absolutely.
Was that in your time when you were MD?
Yeah.
So did you? Why? Was that the biggest client in the country at the time?
Biggest client in the agency, that's for sure. Oh, it was a huge client. But they'd sent a man over from Detroit, whose name was, because he introduced himself as, "Hi there, Paul Tippett. Hi there, Paul Tippett. Hi there, Paul Tippett." and he also referred to his wife as my bride. And we had a dinner with him. And he explained to us that he knew how we worked, but we'd have to work differently. He would write Ricard to see five different campaigns, and he would choose which one he liked. And I said, I said, we don't work like that. We can't work like that. That's just not the way we work. We'll do you one campaign, and when we've got it as we believe in it, we'll show it to you. If you don't like it, we'll probably then do another, provided you can even not like it because you don't like it. I mean, people are allowed to say, I just don't like it. And if you keep on doing that, then you've got the wrong agency. But this was impossible conversation. And he had heavy welts on his shoes. I'm not sure why that mattered to me, but they stick in my mind. Yeah. And the next morning I went up to see John Pearce and said, John, I'm afraid we're going to have to fire Ford. And I explained to him what had happened, and John, what, yes, hello, what? And he said, well, Frank, if you think that's the right thing to do, then I think you'll have to do it. So he was perfectly behind me at this crucial moment in my career.
How long had you been at MD at that point?
I'd been MD about 18 months.
Jesus. So that's a big call. That's a big call to fire the agency's biggest client.
Yeah, but you see, if I'd not done that, I'd have lost the whole confidence agency of the creative department. Because I'd have gone and said, we need five... Frank, we don't do five campaigns, you know that. But I said to John, do me a favour, come up with me to Ford, because I can't just go on my own. And he came up with me and sat in a meeting. I presented them the letter saying that we would like to make new arrangements for their advertising. The client, that man, said, OK, you made your point. Now, fuck off and do some advertising. And the chairman, a man called Walter Hayes, who was a PR person, said to him, you clot. You just cost us the best agency in Britain.
Really?
I remember every word of that meeting. It was ingrained in my heart.
So how was that? Did that feel good? Or was it scary?
It was scary. It didn't feel good or bad. Nobody likes firing a client. I fired Nestle. I didn't feel good about that, but they were impossible. I've had Quaker Oats. But only a few times when you feel that they're going to harm the agency, and most important, you're not going to do any good work for them.
No.
So it became a bit of a nightmare, that. So it doesn't feel... You feel rotten. You feel you have failed somehow to persuade the client that your way of working or your advertising or something is right, and you have not been able to persuade them, and I couldn't persuade them. And so I saw that as a failure. A lot of people say, oh, you go around, I'm a tough boy, I can... Not at all, not at all. Nobody likes firing a client. I'm not sure the same is true of the clients, but still, but they're not firing agencies. But it's not a happy occurrence.
Because somebody took me through, they were saying how you would sell work. They gave me an example.
What's the example?
The example was that you would be very bold. So someone may turn down the campaign. And this, the example he gave, someone used to work, said, you may say, are you confident enough to turn this down and to know that this won't affect your business? That the business could go in two directions and you could be less successful by turning this down and going with something else. Which I haven't seen anyone try that approach.
Well, I did.
But it's true.
I did,
say,
but in a way, I saw advertising as capital investment.
Yeah.
It was not just that you were investing your capital in advertising. You might invest it in a factory, but it's capital investment. And you want to make sure that you've got to get it right and the risks you are taking. I think people shouldn't turn down things lightly when clever people have thought about them for a long time and come up with something. It's not a kind of, well, I don't really like that.
But most people don't have that self-belief to think that or say it. They don't think...
Oh.
I don't know whether... Is that self-belief? What is that?
I think that,
it's an unusual way to...
I tell you, it comes out of having confidence in the work. If you have confidence in creative work, it builds your self-belief. If you go down there with something not too good...
But it also must come from having confidence in your own opinion.
Well, I
that
think
you have confidence
true.
In the work.
Yeah, but you see, that Millward had confidence in his opinion. Parker had confidence in his opinion. I remember when... Alan came over to see me for dinner one night and we were chatting away and he said, listen, I've written the first 30 pages of a script. Would you like to read it? And I read it. Now, I don't know about reading film scripts. I mean, that's not my 30 seconds is my métier. He said, what do you think? I said, well, I think it's rather charming. I have no idea if it'll make a good film, but it's a good idea. But I said, if you do make it into a film, I've got a suggestion for who could do the music for you. But anyway, which he used in the end. But he went away and finished his script. It was Bugsy Malone.
Right.
Now, he had complete confidence in splurge guns.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that because I couldn't read film. I mean, I know that you could make a film out of...
but you wouldn't know whether it would find an audience.
Dickens or Cape, because you know the story and there it is. But not out of somebody inventing... a gangster film for 14-year-olds. And it was a brilliant idea. Do you know, it's interesting that, because Alan is still as close to me as ever was after 40 years. We talk and have lunch. He and I and Hugh have lunch every 4 weeks.
Do you really?
Still do. And, but Bugsy is the most, second most performed play, musical play, in schools around the world after Wizard of Oz.
God, that's amazing, isn't it?
And Alan is one. He lets the music for nothing.
Does he?
Doesn't charge a royalty if it's a school. And he's on my board of trustees. You know, I built a school.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's on the board of trustees of that. And last year, without him knowing, they chose Bugsy Malone. And dear old Alan went up and showed them how to do it.
Did he really?
He rehearsed them. The whole
small
thing.
Small school, yeah.
Dancing.
Brilliant.
And it was a really good performance. But you can imagine when they were telling you, so we've got somebody who's going to help you with it. And it was Alan.
Wow.
So he's a good man. I have to tell you, I have met, in my career in advertising, nearly all good people. I've remained friends with the person I was very close to. There were one or two people who I wouldn't wish ever to see again because they had just not done what I believe they should do. But... most of them, mostly all the creative people. I've never met nasty creative people.
Have you not?
No, I can't remember nasty.
Generally, I don't think they are.
They're not. Lighters, cameramen, they're all delightful. Still pals with Saracen and that kind of thing.
So I've got a question for you. I think I read that Colin Wilde was probably your biggest influence, single
yes,
influence.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because... at Colletts, he had a strong opinion. He shaped the whole feel and tone of the place.
Yes, he did.
His aesthetics particularly come through.
Yes.
And yet, when you were managing director, you never appointed an art director to be any of your creative directors. Well, in the way that Arden did was.
Well, this is not deliberate. I mean, somebody else asked me that a while ago, just as somebody en passant. But I appointed Salmon because Salmon was actually semi-appointed by Millwood anyway. He was going to take over. He was a writer, a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
A brilliant writer. But, so that was that. But, and it, you know, you couldn't make Waldy creative director. Yeah. I mean, not unless you want to go insane. On the other hand, Hegarty's an art director.
Yeah, there's a few. Generally, they're writers for some reason.
Charlie was a writer.
Yeah.
Arden was an art director. Webster was an art director. But generally, I think one of the reasons, I don't know, I was trying to think about why this might be. I wondered partly it might be that art directors have to spend so much of their time going around the world shooting and photography.
That's true,
they haven't got time to sit in their office and read all the copy.
Yeah. Well, you can get that aspect done, but art directors generally bring a set of aesthetics and a feel and certain other things that obviously Millwood did. But not many art directors used to be. Hegarty was a very rare one.
Yes, that's
at
right.
At that time, there weren't many. It was almost like they weren't trusted. You know, I'm an art director, so I'm slightly biased.
Art director. Yeah, I you may be right. I mean,
so you would have had Adrian Holmes. And
mind you, Adrian was
Mark
very good
Antonio
writer.
And
yeah, a good writer.
Writers.
But I think that art directors maybe are more important today because of virtually no copy in anything.
Yeah.
There's no copy in television commercials that you can... I mean, you know, I can... Now, girls, your last day at the school for
amazing
young ladies. Pen books open, checkbooks open, girl. Pens at the readiest. No. Felicity, one doesn't go shopping in Knightsbridge. You have one of these. You know, David Brown wrote this beautiful copy which she articulated. And I think copy has a very important part to play, but it's not in television anymore. It is normally the copy is spoken by a voiceover telling you to do something.
Yeah.
And often shouting at you to do something.
Yeah.
But I... a lot of people... I remember the media situation where your media broke away. I was very disappointed because I think media and creativity and the work I did were all...
Yeah.
...worked together so perfectly. We had a wonderful media director called Mike Yershin. They decided to break away. Now, if you ask them why they broke away, they may give you a lot of reasons. But the real reason they broke away was that, first of all, they could make more money out of running their own media company. And secondly, they were sick to death of playing second fiddle to the creative department.
Really, yeah.
They didn't like it. Because you do a presentation, and the client would be fascinated by the work. He'd go on and on and on. I think I've got to go now. Are we going for lunch? Are we? Whatever. And I say, well, what about the media? Oh, well, it's in the leave behind, so you can look at it later. And that, the media people felt, was demeaning to them. Now, the truth of the matter is that I have no wish to demean. I mean, the wonderful story of how I got that one-minute commercial to 117 for National Provincial Bank, or how we got several ads that we bought time that we never could have done. Great people.
Yeah.
But clients do not go then, didn't go then, to an agency for the media department. They went for the creative work. And they would come in and say, what we really want is great creative. Not what we really want is a good media strategy. So I think they're not second fiddle any more than the account men are, but the client come for that. Now, I think it's a bit of a loss that agencies are so separated from... I may be wrong. Media's changed so dramatically.
As a creative, it seems ridiculous that sometimes you get given a bunch of shapes and they go, we think these shapes will work for this campaign. You think, well, they're all blank. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
It just seems so bizarre that these things are separate. On the very rare occasions when you do work collaboratively with media people, you find they're very flexible and open to trying to understand what you're doing. But often now it's just, these are the shapes, these are the lengths. We think if we buy of this length, it will work great.
I was having lunch with John Hegarty a year or so ago. And I John said, Frank, I'd like you to look at a campaign I've done. And I said, fine. So I looked at it. I said, that's very nice. That's potentially a really nice campaign. I said, it's going to have to breathe, obviously. You know, you need 50s or probably 60s if you can get them. He said, he said, well, there's the problem. The media department, the media company, has already booked 30s.
Yeah.
So I said, but John, they won't fit into 30. He said, well, the clients asked us to cut them down into 30s. And I said, they won't work. I said, it's like taking a two-hour feature film and saying, can you cut it down to an hour? It won't work. I don't think they ran the campaign, but I think it's they should be closer to the creative people than they are. but media now has become so complicated. It's really difficult. I mean, I read a lot about what's going on in the national press and everything. But it's very difficult to know what's actually going on. I'm very worried. If somebody would ask me about what worries me about, I'm worried that people don't want it.
No.
I really am worried. My Sid said nobody wants to work in it, the boys, and I don't think they want it. 30% of ads are blocked.
Yeah.
Mute button there all the time. They measure a viewing in some instances. If somebody sees 6 seconds of a commercial, that counts as an impact. Yeah. That's obviously nonsense.
Yeah.
I don't know who can believe that. So I'm very worried about media having got control of the business. The business is getting a bit out of control.
Absolutely. What do you think started this change from where it was? When do you think it changed? Digital, presumably, when that started.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was digital, and digital brought in a world that a lot of people couldn't really understand, and therefore the media, who'd now left and got in contact with the clients, working hand in hand with the clients, the media could say, well, we'll get this, we'll have this, we'll do that.
Yeah.
And I don't think the clients understood what was going on half the time. I mean, if you talk to Keith Weed, I had lunch, you know, Unilever, I had lunch with him last year sometime. And I was talking about this, and I said, you know, aren't you worried about people actually seeing your work? He said, I am very worried about actually seeing it. Now, if you add that on to the fact that perhaps one or two people do not consider the advertising as fabulous as it might be, you've got a pretty messy thing. Not great advertising, not which watched very much, in the wrong place.
Absolutely.
So I think advertising, and I mean, I won't, no names, no pack drill, but I've talking to the heads of top people at the IPA or DNAD, they would say to you privately, we think our business is screwed.
Mm. It's looking that way at the moment.
Yeah, well, you know, and I am... I don't know what you can do about it. I'm too old and done my bit, and I've no desire to have any involvement in advertising and just observe it. But when I think back, I do think advertising has had a role to uplift people for your visit, to make them feel pleased for your visit.
Mm.
Oh, I like that Hamlet ad. Wasn't that funny in the bunker? You know, that kind of thing. And I think advertising has lost its charm.
Yeah.
And charm is essential to anybody. I mean, these people, when you meet people, are they charming or are they not? I mean, betting advertising is execrable.
Yeah.
And that man, who oddly enough is a friend of Michael Caine's,
which one's that?
The man who does that Bet 364. Well, I remember gamble responsibly.
Oh,
he's an actor.
Ray Winston.
Yeah. Oh, he's really deeply unpleasant. I said that to Mike. He said, well, he's a bloody good actor, so we did him off those commercials. But he said, Michael said, he got a lot of money for them.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Bought a house in Italy.
Yeah, off the back of those.
Yes. But then, I think, what's her name from Fawlty Towers? Sybil bought a new home out of the Tesco.
Did she really?
Yeah. And quite right. Because
yeah,
if she could increase the sales of Tesco, when he started that account, it had 13% of the market. 15 years later, it had 23. Now, you can imagine how much money 10% of the supermarket business is. So the cost of paying her a decent fee to do her acting is nothing. Absolutely nothing.
So when you started Lowe's,
mm,
what was the plan? There's one thing that really strikes me, because when you talk about advertising and the creative process. You seem so animated.
I am.
Obviously care about it.
Yeah.
And yet you set up an agency without a creative person.
Well, I didn't set up an agency without a creative
person. Well, no, that's true. You didn't set up an agency without a creative, an equal.
No, I didn't have a creative.
You didn't have a creative on the door, I guess.
No, because I.
To be more accurate.
Well, who would I get?
So several of the creatives who used to work for you said you should have called yourself the creative director. Because they said at Colletts you were like the creative director. So sometimes you would say, I think the end doesn't work. Sometimes you'd look at the copy on Stella and say, I think that's our campaign.
Sometimes I'd choose
sometimes
the music,
you'd overrule John Salmon and people.
But John,
why would you not?
You know, I would sometimes, and sometimes disagree, but it's Millwood, isn't it? It's Millwood with his miserable voice. Don't think it's very good.
He's in the back of your mind.
I had some very good creative people.
You hired great creative people.
O'Driscoll, I thought, was Kelly. Very good. Mark Antonio, very good. But there wasn't one person at CDP I would have taken as the creative director because there was only Salmon. Parker had gone off to make films.
Is there anyone outside that you would have thought maybe I could speak to them?
Abbott.
You would have,
but he wasn't available. Webster,
but
he wasn't available. So those are the two I admired most. Right. Webster, I admired enormously. I thought he was just fantastic.
Could you see when you worked with him pre BMP what would evolve?
Oh yes,
really?
Absolutely.
Because he didn't go there to be the named partner or the
creative
director.
No, he did not. But you could look at his creative. The work he did on National Provincial Bank was beautiful with the little girl.
Yeah, it's great.
I cannot understand why other sensible and mature people do not take a more responsible attitude towards their financial.
You should remember every word,
And she had a little pig. I put a little by each week into Horace. Yeah. And it was so. But he did that. He did some marvellous, did some excellent work on Rover. Very good indeed. Yeah. So you could see that he was really very good. Of course, he did the smash.
Yeah.
And on and on and on. He was great talent. A great talent. And I think he's as good a creative man as you would find in London. I mean, I had at Colletts several, all of whom were brilliant in many ways, but I think Webster, print, everything, he was fantastic. And Abbott, of course.
And what about Abbott? Did you know Abbott?
Yeah. Abbott was a Brignall, Salmon and Abbott were, for my taste, the three great print copywriters. And they wrote beautiful copy and brilliant print advertising. Now, it's not to say that they couldn't do television, but their greatest skill was writing copy that you would just read through it and enjoy it, like a book.
Yeah.
And the use of the English language. I remember Tony had written a lovely commercial for Clark Shoes about a little shoe. It was for a little child. It was just the shoe, this little shoe, and it was on the screen. And it was perfect. Birnbach's favourite commercial from England, curiously, I found out later. His favourite ad that we did. But instead of saying, the back fits the heels of the child, it cradles the heel.
Yeah.
Those words, to me, are just different
in
the way of writing. Tony, of course, went up to get a professorship of English at Oxford.
Did he?
Yeah, when he retired. And he felt a bit embarrassed sitting with all these 22-year-olds, but what a wonderful thing for him to do. Neil went off to paint, and he's down in Devon. And Neil was—he was like Colin,
was he?
Just like Colin. But what an art director! What an art director to say, Neil, God, that's beautifully laid out. That's beautifully done, and I think he was the best art director this country ever had.
Do you think?
Yes, I do think so.
Who do you think's the most talented person you've come across in all your time in the business? If one had to spring to mind. I know you don't want to.
I suppose, Alan.
Alan Parker, really.
He wrote wonderful commercials. He shot fantastic commercials. And he made 14 feature films, which between them won several Oscars.
Yeah.
So I think probably the most talented. But that's not to diminish.
No, of course.
Ridley, of course, is a director.
Charles Saatchi, all of these people.
Charlie. Yeah. Charlie never...
Did you work with him at
Benton Bowles?
At Benton and Bowles,
yeah. But Charlie never fulfilled his promise as a writer, in the sense that when he got into building Saatchi, I think he stopped writing.
Yeah.
But he wrote one of my favourite print ads, which was an ad for... The Ford GT40, do you remember that sports car, that wonderful looking sports car? And it was an extraordinary thing. And
he had a picture of the car,
and the headline was said, because Fords didn't have a good reputation, it said, "Would you let your daughter marry a Ford owner?"
Right. Brilliant.
And that is the joy to me. I couldn't write that. But if I could recognise it and sell it, that's just as important.
Have you ever written an ad?
Oh, yes.
Have you?
Yes, but nothing I'd like to... no, I don't think... I think that's what I described to you earlier. Don't pick up the pencil and try and tinker with it. Say, I don't like it. I'm sure you can do better. But how do you like this? With a few words, you know, a few little well-chosen thoughts.
Yeah.
So I think Alan probably... But I wouldn't... Waldy was... That one campaign has made him famous in the advertising annals. It's like photographers. It's like each of them has their own special niche, and each of them, you remember them for what they did. I think one of the things at the moment is you have to show the work. I mean, every agency can talk a good line. We're really into creative. We care about the creative product. Could I see the reel, please? Then you can see how good the agency, not how they talk about it, but how they show it.
So, if we end on something optimistic, what would you,
I don't know,
when you look at the business now? I mean, it occurred to me that most of the, it's interesting that most of the agencies are run by two finance guys, Martin Sorrell and, well, not anymore, but Martin Sorrell and the guy at Omnicom, John Wren. The guy who runs Publicis and now BBH and all those other agencies came from the computer department, but not people who've got any feel for the actual products that they're selling.
I think there's one or two things. First of all, the advertising business, creative part of it, has been massively affected by the public companies. There are four public companies or five that own, I don't know, 80% of the world's agencies. And since the public companies are only interested in making money, creative work is a means to making money, not a means to selling the client's product. And so if the client doesn't like something, well, change it. It's like the old time of thing about the client says, "What time is it?" And you say, "What time would you like it to be?"
Yeah.
So I think that is a big problem. Now, I do foresee in the end these companies may break up. There's a lot of young agencies in London at the moment with odd names and doing odd bits of work. But I think they may break up because I don't think advertising is a thing that should be public. I don't think it should, because you have, you know, in public company you have the client, who is manufacturer, and the consumer who buys the products. And that's a dialogue going on. I make this, would you like to buy it? But in advertising, you used to have the client and the agency. You now introduced a third partner, a third gentleman sitting at the table, who is called a shareholder. So you've now got two people to take account
of. Yeah.
And I don't think that's a great idea. So I think I hope... But the real problem is, I sincerely hope to see a brilliant new generation learning how to use the media in its new form to do brilliant work. And I believe that will happen.
I think it's happening now. There's a big change going on.
I think
there.
So. Yeah. Because it's not satisfactory to just sit there being dull, is it? I mean, just not satisfactory. So I am hopeful.
I guess the thing that the biggest driver of that is how which is partly why I do these, is the individuals and how they feel. And when you talk about it, you can tell how much it means. And it's difficult to make people feel, to get people to feel that you either do or you don't.
I'm afraid that is true. You either do or you don't.
And I think it meant more in previous times than it does now. And I don't know. There's a whole number of factors. There's a lot more competition for creative people because there's more money in other areas. But.
Well, that's perfectly true, but something will emerge. I mean, if you look at American advertising in the 50s, when they did that Mad thing, Mad Men thing. To start with, I was interested. They never showed any advertising in that because the advertising in the 50s was crap. Yeah. And then, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Birnbach arrived. And he and that amazing team revolutionised advertising. Now, about 6 years later, all of a sudden, Millward, Pierce and Collitz arrived and revolutionised advertising here. And lots of spin-offs. We had Abbott Mead, we had Bosmasimi, they had Chiat Day, they had Mary Wells. And I think at some point, there will be a new way, some little group of people, somebody will say, we could do better than this and do it. And, it's very hard to predict. You can't predict who it will be.
But it's likely to happen. But it's a backlash.
New York, Birnbach, it rose curiously out of Jewish copywriters and Italian art directors. Yeah. They working together. And that's why they did those wonderful ads for Levi's Rye Bread and things like that. Our thing, I think, was an emergence post-war of the working classes who'd had such a rotten time and really rationed books and everything our parents had. Then I think they thought, right, I'm going to do something. And that's how the 60s emerged here in all the different forms of art and fashion and everything. And advertising came one of it. Where it is now, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on where fashion is right now or where music is right now. But certainly that was an extraordinary explosion of people, as if they were crying to get out.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it seems like it was challenging the old ways. So if something had been the case for 20 years, that's a good enough reason to change it. Whereas I think it's in a situation now where people seem to just go along, it is what it is, this is how it is. And at some point, people must rebel against that.
I think they will.
So I'm going to put some pictures with this and some films with this. So I'm going to ask you some quick questions on...
Oh, dear.
What's your favourite ad that you've been involved with? It doesn't have to be the right answer. It's whatever springs to mind.
Benson Hedges. Film, the film.
Benson and Hedges film.
Because it was revolutionary.
What about print? Benson Hedges again?
Benson Hedges again.
Okay. What do you think is the most consequential ad that you've been involved with?
Benson Hedges.
Would you say that?
Oh, yeah.
So I was going to wonder whether it might be something like the National Provincial ad. Only because it must have set you up.
Oh, you mean as far as I'm concerned?
In terms of what had the biggest effect on your career.
It was National Provincial, and I'll tell you why. Because having found out that, the little girl couldn't say it, they said, well, she'll have to cut 20 seconds out of the script. Now, it had taken Maggie Randall, the TV producer, 2 months to teach her the script. So the idea of going to say, can you cut these? Impossible. And secondly, of course, she wanted to go to the loo in the middle of the commercial.
Yeah, that's right, which makes it amazing.
And the client said, you can't have that. I said, that's child. Every mother in the country will laugh at that. And
it's also great that she's so small in the frame.
Well, that was Lee. Perfectly. Tiny in that huge screen.
She looks amazing.
Walking along, looking for her mark.
Yeah.
That showed me, by getting that length, going to the loo film, that showed me an accountant can play a very important part in the making of advertising, not, as John Pierce used to say, carrying the bags and buying the booze.
Yeah. Which ads do you wish you'd been involved in? Is there an ad that springs to mind?
Oh, John Smith's by the one with the dog.
John Smith's dog.
I love that one with the dog jumping up and down.
Yeah.
I thought that was very good. I thought Gertrude.
Yeah.
I love that campaign. I thought that was extremely good. I thought Abbott's, the board and I don't like the colour of your eyes. That print campaign and Abbott Sainsbury campaign I thought was fantastic. And it really brought the importance of food into a supermarket, not just going along, filling your basket, but thinking, I'm not sure that, I mean, there are lots of tons of ads I've really liked, but Hamlet.
Oh. Which one would you pick?
Oh, that, put a Hamlet the hat? One was, that was my one, it wasn't my idea. But I always wanted to do an ad, and I said to Chris, can we do a Hamlet ad where we never see the person or the pack? And because I always wanted to do that. It was Bunker.
Yeah, that's great.
And I said, I've always wanted to do that. And, of course, it proved so, because you only had to hear the first note of the music.
Yeah.
And everybody... Music is, of course, vital. Now, I'm unhappy about music at the moment, because so many ads seem to me to be just, let's choose a pop song and put some footage together with it.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I mean, if you think the original Benson Hedges ads, you think of Vangelis and the Ben, you think of Hamlet, the Hovis music, which is, you know...
Well, they're mnemonics, aren't they, that you instantly know where you are.
It's the Black Dyke Mills Band, who used to come and practice in my pub.
Did they?
Well, because they used to have the big brass band contest.
In your pub up in Manchester.
Because we were near Bellevue, and they used to have the contest there. So one of the bands would take a pub, and Black Grout used to take our pub, and I used to sit on the steps looking
so
down.
So did you suggest them?
What?
Did you suggest
them? Well, actually, curiously enough, in a half a way I did, but we'd already used that music on a Bird's Eye commercial for...
How do you mean?
No. We used it on a... that. What the bloody product was? Lancashire Hot Pot? Something like that. Anyway, and the script, it was Joe Gladwin did the script. That's a wonderful old actor. And it said, Bird's Eye, whatever it was. It takes about 20 minutes to prepare and cook. Normal one. You daddy, daddy, daddy. Normally it takes 2.5 hours. Well, when they made the product, it did take 2.5 hours to thaw and cook. But by then, we'd made a lovely commercial, and we'd put the music, which Alan Marshall took from the film The Charlton Brothers with the Black Dyke Band. And I said, well, let's use that music on that commercial. And Salmon said, absolutely, let's do that. Salmon was very supportive of that. So that's how it all came about. Right. Everybody had a little paw in it. Yeah. But I think the original idea was Alan Marshall taking it for that Bird's Eye product. It's so beautiful, that.
Great, yeah.
And the thing that I love about it is, you know, they... the brass bands in the north, brass bands in the north. I always have a Lancashire accent when I get excited.
Yeah.
They don't use a trumpet; they use a cornet.
Right.
And a cornet has that mournful. It's a mournful sound.
Right.
And I just think, so who would say? I mean, if you'd ask me, you don't know. You might remember the Coburn's Port ad commercial with the shipwreck.
That's just one of the best.
And Jeff Seymour wrote that. Yeah. I think that was brilliant.
Yeah.
But, of course, it was a one-off ad for Coburn's Port. Ran 3 Christmases in a row, but Coburn's was not... Cockburn's, is it?
Yeah. But that's one of those, like the Parker, that's so perfectly
yes,
written.
Yes, it was perfectly made, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Very good. You see, we get good actors. I mean, Benson Hedges... all those ones which Ridley shot a lot of, Bob Brooks shot some. Very good actors. I mean, we had a...
Well, I love the one with George Cole.
Oh, that, it's just amazing. I think that was Bob Brooks.
Was it?
I think that was the most perfectly edited commercial as he went through the whole thing, and you look at the... I just think it was a perfectly told story with the denouement at the end.
Great that lots of them are very long shots, so you feel like you're sort of spying in on them.
There was a lot of that. Ridley used that a lot. That long lens stuff had come... Hovis was that, wasn't it? His bike coming up the hill towards you. I thought that was a perfect, perfect commercial, that. And I remember we did a commercial with... Terry Thomas.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's
Eric
when he put his hand
in the underground.
Yeah.
That was funny, wasn't it? And there was a terrific argument about the... there was an argument. You couldn't do this today. About who would get... And Terry Thomas, agent, said, I don't really mind what I get, but it must be more than Eric.
Oh, really?
So we're sitting there thinking, how could we deal with this? Because we know they're going to tell each other what they earn. It's like in an advertising agency, keep your salary secret. Nobody does. But in the end, we had this idea. Terry was a smoker, so we gave him a lifetime supply of Benson and Hedges and the same fee. That was not a good thing to do as we look at it today, was it? It was a terrible thing
to
do.
Could have cost him 2 years.
I know. What a wonderful man,
yeah.
Terry Thomas. Such a funny man with his tooth. Yeah, good shout. Yeah. I liked him very much. But again, you see, they were acting. To use Peter Sellers in a commercial we shot in Malta, jumping in the boat with Spike Milligan. Again, they were acting. Yeah. And I think that's what's terribly important. And I think...
It's a shame all this stuff isn't easily accessible now. That lots of that stuff is you can't find anywhere.
You can find it all on... Where you can find it, Louise, you can find
it
on...
You can find some of it on HAT, History of Advertising Trust. But really it starts in... Because they found two garage lockups of all the stuff that had been entered for the British Television.
Really?
Yeah. So it's an amazing find. I did the ads for it, funnily enough. But the someone found two garages stuffed with...
Stuff.
What do they call those old tapes? Before VHS. The big, bulky...
8-track?
What was those big machines we used to have in our office? Yeah. Whatever that was called.
Big thing you pushed in.
The big thing, yeah. U-matics. Stuffed with U-matics. That from 1977 to 2000 and something. Jam-packed. But not just the ones that had won awards, the ones that had been entered. So someone stumbled across them.
Dear God.
And then they did a deal with someone to digitise it all. And then that was a sort of...
Fantastic
company, and anyway, that's now on the HAT site. But that only starts at so that's got more or less everything from 77, which is a great site. But all of the ones like the Terry Thomas, I mean, that's probably on YouTube. There's certain things
they
there,
are.
But
if
it's
you
a
look
shame
up
they're not more
the agency,
coveted.
Or if you look at Ridley, may have it, or whoever shot it. You can find most of them though,
yeah.
But you know, there
but
was
you turn
a joy.
Out so much
what
stuff,
I
it's
used
a shame.
To do, with you talk about all those different ads, and I'm sure Bose Massimi was the same, because they had a very good reel, not just for Mash Get Smash.
No, they had depth. Yeah.
But we didn't used to do case histories if a new business prospect came in. You'd say, well, can tell us about your advertising. We'd say, well, you name a client, and we'll have a case history to show you.
Yeah.
But we had them all, and you can pick which one you want. Because anybody can choose three or four ads and ignore the rest. I mean, a lot of agencies that completely sideline a lot of their stuff for knickers and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's another campaign. I'm sure it's successful. And it doesn't matter. It's for Sillit Bang.
Sillit Bang, yeah.
It's just not my cup of tea, that.
No,
I don't
it doesn't
know.
Look,
does it?
Not, it doesn't look like your kind of thing.
And it's... shouting away at you. But of course, if it's Unilever, it'd be Unilever or Proctor's, I imagine. But they have an advantage because they have control over the raw material. Because you can't just set up a factory to... They've got
right,
that.
Yeah.
They have control over the distribution.
Yeah.
And that's huge. And they do have control over the pricing. So really, it's almost impossible to get
into
their
market.
It can't be done. You can launch a new beer, you can launch another cigar, you can launch lots of things, but I don't think you can break into their markets. I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, that's why they've been predominant, although they spend huge quantities of money on advertising.
Yeah.
I mean,
bludgeon their way there.
Bludgeon their way there. Is that enough for
you? Amazing. I've got one last question. What's it like being a knight?
Well, I'd be
you get
dishonest.
Discounts? What do you? What's good? What
I'd be dishonest, Alan would say. When I got the letter inviting me, I had no idea, from Blair, because it was really because of the school I built, this first academy.
Mm.
I was astonished. And I was absolutely thrilled. And I couldn't wait to ring my mum and tell her.
Yeah, mate.
Because... up from the north, a lad like that gets a knighthood. I would be less than honest if I didn't say I was very excited and very flattered. And I thought, wow, you've come a long way since the pub.
Yeah.
I know it'd be cool. So,
what do you get? You get a letter in the post? Does
you get
someone
a letter
come round
from the Prime Minister asking if you'll accept it, which you reply. Then you have to keep stum until they announce it. So I couldn't tell anybody, not even my kids. I couldn't tell them. And then they came dashing, came down, I knew when it was coming out, from the paper shop. Papa! There it was. So that was very nice. And then you go to the Her Majesty and...
She does that?
Yes, she does that. And, but they always have a question. So I was actually knighted by Prince Charles.
Right.
Because I, it was convenient for everything. And he said, "Hello, Frank, how are you?" I said, "I'm very well, sir." He said, "How's the advertising business?" So I thought that was rather... They're obviously brief.
Yeah, yeah,
Jackie
sure.
Stewart was the only Charming one who got a knighthood the same day as me. "Jackie, how are you? And how's the motor racing business?"
Yeah, yeah, brilliant.
But it would be dishonest and dissembling to say it isn't very a thrill to have that. And, you know, who knows who earns what. I mean, it pisses me off that certain people... You know, Bailey should have a knighthood.
Yeah.
He hasn't.
Has he not?
And he should. And McCullen's got one.
Has he? Sir John McCullen.
Mm-hmm. Parker's got one. A lot of them. But Bailey should have a knighthood. He was a revolutionary photographer in the 60s and 70s. And I think he deserves that. And he's so cross about it.
Is he?
Oh! He's got the OBE. And I'm moaning it came in the paper that I got a knighthood. And I love Bailey. He's a wonderful man. We've known each other for forever. And he rang me up and said, "Well, fuck you, Frank. I'm sending my OBE back."
Brilliant. Right, it's been amazing. Thanks for coming here. Really appreciate it. I know you don't do this much. Really
I don't.
Appreciate your time.
I have no intention of doing it again.
No, it's good. We got,
worn me out.
Yeah, good. No, brilliant.
Louise. Lewis. We go, no, don't panic. We're going for a beer.
Yeah.